associations in order to escape the impossible task of enlightening him about my very personal and utterly different constitution. I must apologize for this rather lengthy narration of the jam I got into through telling Freud my dream, but it is a good example of the difficulties in which one gets involved in the course of a real dream analysis. So much depends upon the personal differences between the analyst and the analyzed. I soon realized that Freud was looking for some incompatible wish of mine, and so I suggested tentatively that the skulls I had dreamed of might refer to certain members of my family whose death, for some reason, I might desire. This proposal met with his approval, but I was not satisfied with such a phony solution. While I was trying to find a suitable answer to Freud's questions, I was suddenly confused by an intuition about the role that the subjective factor plays in psychological understanding. My intuition was so overwhelming that I thought only of how to get out of this impossible snarl, and I took the easy way out by a lie. This was neither elegant nor morally defensible, but otherwise I should have risked a fatal row with Freud, and I did not feel up to that for many reasons. My intuition consisted of the sudden and most unexpected insight into the fact that my dream meant myself, my life, and my world, my whole reality against a theoretical structure erected by another strange mind for reasons and purposes of its own. It was not Freud's dream, it was mine, and I understood suddenly in a flash what my dream meant. This conflict illustrates a vital point about dream analysis. It is not so much a technique that can be learned and applied according to the rules as it is a dialectical exchange between two personalities. If it is handled as a mechanical technique, the individual psychic personality of the dreamer gets lost, and the therapeutic problem is reduced to the simple question, which of the two people concerned, the analyst or the dreamer, will dominate the other? I gave up hypnotic treatment for this very reason, because I did not want to impose my will on others. I wanted the healing processes to grow out of the patient's own personality, not from suggestions by me that would have only a passing effect. My aim was to protect and preserve my patient's dignity and freedom so that he could live his life according to his own wishes. In this exchange with Freud, it dawned on me for the first time that before we construct general theories about man and his psyche, we should learn a lot more about the real human being we have to deal with. The individual is the only reality. The further we move away from the individual toward abstract ideas about Homo sapiens, the more likely we are to fall into error. In these times of social upheaval and rapid change, it is desirable to know much more than we do about the individual human being, for so much depends upon his mental and moral qualities. But if we are to see things in their right perspective, we need to understand the past of man as well as his present. That is why an understanding of myths and symbols is of essential importance. The problem of types. In all other branches of science, it is legitimate to apply a hypothesis to an impersonal subject. Psychology, however, inescapably confronts you with the living relations between two individuals, neither of whom can be divested of his subjective personality, nor indeed depersonalized in any other way. The analyst and his patient may set out by agreeing to deal with a chosen problem in an impersonal and objective manner, but once they are engaged, their whole personalities are involved in their discussion. At this point, further progress is possible only if mutual agreement can be reached. Can we make any sort of objective judgment about the final result? Only if we make a comparison between our conclusions and the standards that are generally valid in the social milieu to which the individuals belong. Even then, we must take into account the mental equilibrium or sanity of the individual concerned. For the result cannot be a completely collective leveling out of the individual to adjust him to the norms of his society. This would amount to a most unnatural condition. A sane and normal society is one in which people habitually disagree because general agreement is relatively rare outside the sphere of instinctive human qualities. Disagreement functions as a vehicle of mental life in society, but it is not a goal. Agreement is equally important. Because psychology basically depends upon balanced opposites, no judgment can be considered to be final in which its reversibility has not been taken into account. The reason for this peculiarity lies in the fact that there is no standpoint above or outside psychology that would enable us to form an ultimate judgment of what the psyche is. In spite of the fact that dreams demand individual treatment, some generalities are necessary in order to classify and clarify the material that the psychologist collects by studying many individuals. It would obviously be impossible to formulate any psychological theory or to teach it by describing large numbers of separate cases without any effort to see what they have in common and how they differ. Any general characteristic can be chosen as a basis. One can, for instance, make a relatively simple distinction between individuals who have extroverted personalities and others who are introverted. This is only one of many possible generalizations, but it enables one to see immediately the difficulties that can arise if the analyst should happen to be one type and his patient the other. Since any deeper analysis of dreams leads to the confrontation of two individuals, it will obviously make a great difference whether their types of attitude are the same or not. If both belong to the same type, they may sail along happily for a long time, but if one is an extrovert and the other an introvert, their different and contradictory standpoints may clash right away, particularly when they are unaware of their own type of personality or when they are convinced that their own is the only right type. The extrovert, for instance, will choose the majority view. The introvert will reject it simply because it is fashionable. Such a misunderstanding is easy enough because the value of the one is the non-value of the other. Freud himself, for instance, interpreted the introverted type as an individual morbidly concerned with himself. But introspection and self-knowledge can just as well be of the greatest value and importance. It is vitally necessary to take account of such differences of personality in dream interpretation. It cannot be assumed that the analyst is a superman who is above such differences, just because he is a doctor who has acquired a psychological theory and a corresponding technique. He can only imagine himself to be superior insofar as he assumes that his theory and technique are absolute truths, capable of embracing the whole of the human psyche. Since such an assumption is more than doubtful, he cannot really be sure of it. Consequently, he will be assailed by secret doubts if he confronts the human wholeness of his patient with a theory or technique, which is merely a hypothesis or an attempt, instead of with his own living wholeness. The analyst's whole personality is the only adequate equivalent of his patient's personality. Psychological experience and knowledge do not amount to more than mere advantages on the side of the analyst. They do not keep him outside the fray, in which he is bound to be tested just as much as his patient. Thus, it matters a good deal whether their personalities are harmonious, in conflict, or complementary. Extroversion and introversion are just two among many peculiarities of human behavior, but they are often rather obvious and easily recognizable. If one studies extroverted individuals, for instance, one soon discovers that they differ in many ways from one another, and that being extroverted is therefore a superficial and too general criterion to be really characteristic. That is why, long ago, I tried to find some further basic peculiarities that might serve the purpose of giving some order to the apparently limitless variations in human individuality. I had always been impressed by the fact that there are a surprising number of individuals who never use their minds if they can avoid it, and an equal number who do use their minds, but in an amazingly stupid way. I was also surprised to find many intelligent and wide-awake people who lived, as far as one could make out, as if they had never learned to use their sense organs. They did not see the things before their eyes, hear the words sounding in their ears, or notice the things they touched or tasted. Some lived without being aware of the state of their own bodies. There were others who seemed to live in a most curious condition of consciousness, as if the state they had arrived at today were final, with no possibility of change, or as if the world and the psyche were static and would remain so forever. They seemed devoid of all imagination, and they entirely and exclusively depended upon their sense perception. Chances and possibilities did not exist in their world, and in today there was no real tomorrow. The future was just the repetition of the past. I am trying here to give the reader a glimpse of my own first impressions when I began to observe the many people I met. It soon became clear to me, however, that the people who used their minds were those who thought, that is, who applied their intellectual faculty in trying to adapt themselves to people and circumstances. And the equally intelligent people who did not think were those who sought and found their way by feeling. Feeling is a word that needs some explanation. For instance, one speaks of feeling when it is a matter of sentiment, corresponding to the French term sentiment. But one also applies the same word to define an opinion. For example, a communication from the White House may begin, "The President feels." Furthermore, the word may be used to express an intuition. "I had a feeling as if..." When I use the word feeling, in contrast to thinking, I refer to a judgment of value, for instance, agreeable or disagreeable, good or bad, and so on. Feeling, according to this definition, is not an emotion, which, as the word conveys, is involuntary. Feeling, as I mean it, is, like thinking, a rational, that is, ordering function, whereas intuition is an irrational, that is, perceiving function. Insofar as intuition is a hunch, it is not the product of a voluntary act. It is rather an involuntary event, which depends upon different external or internal circumstances instead of an act of judgment. Intuition is more like a sense perception, which is also an irrational event insofar as it depends essentially upon objective stimuli, which owe their existence to physical and not to mental causes. These four functional types correspond to the obvious means by which consciousness obtains its orientation to experience. Sensation, that is, sense perception, tells you that something exists. Thinking tells you what it is. Feeling tells you whether it is agreeable or not. And intuition tells you whence it comes and where it is going. The reader should understand that these four criteria of types of human behavior are just four viewpoints among many others, like willpower, temperament, imagination, memory, and so on. There is nothing dogmatic about them, but their basic nature recommends them as suitable criteria for a classification. I find them particularly helpful when I am called upon to explain parents to children and husbands to wives, and vice versa. They are also useful in understanding one's own prejudices. Thus, if you want to understand another person's dream, you have to sacrifice your own predilections and suppress your prejudices. This is not easy or comfortable, because it means a moral effort that is not to everyone's taste. But if the analyst does not make the effort to criticize his own standpoint and to admit its relativity, he will get neither the right information about nor sufficient insight into his patient's mind. The analyst expects at least a certain willingness on the patient's part to listen to his opinion and to take it seriously. And the patient must be granted the same right, although such a relationship is indispensable for any understanding and is therefore of self-evident necessity. One must remind oneself again and again that it is more important in therapy for the patient to understand than for the analyst's theoretical expectations to be satisfied. The patient's resistance to the analyst's interpretation is not necessarily wrong. It is rather a sure sign that something does not click. Either the patient has not yet reached the point where he understands, or the interpretation does not fit. In our efforts to interpret the dream symbols of another person, we are almost invariably hampered by our tendency to fill in the unavoidable gaps in our understanding by projection, that is, by the assumption that what the analyst perceives or thinks is equally perceived or thought by the dreamer. To overcome this source of error, I have always insisted on the importance of sticking to the context of the particular dream and excluding all theoretical assumptions about dreams in general, except for the hypothesis that dreams in some way make sense. It will be clear from all I have said that we cannot lay down general rules for interpreting dreams. When I suggested earlier that the overall function of dreams seems to be to compensate for deficiencies or distortions in the conscious mind, I meant that this assumption opened up the most promising approach to the nature of particular dreams. In some cases, you can see this function plainly demonstrated. One of my patients had a very high opinion of himself and was unaware that almost everyone who knew him was irritated by his air of moral superiority. He came to me with a dream in which he had seen a drunken tramp rolling in a ditch, a sight that evoked from him only the patronizing comment, "It's terrible to see how low a man can fall." It was evident that the unpleasant nature of the dream was at least in part an attempt to offset his inflated opinion of his own merits. But there was something more to it than this. It turned out that he had a brother who was a degenerate alcoholic. What the dream also revealed was that his superior attitude was compensating the brother as both an outer and an inner figure. In another case, I recall, a woman who was proud of her intelligent understanding of psychology had recurring dreams about another woman. When in ordinary life she met this woman, she did not like her, thinking her a vain and dishonest intriguer. But in the dreams, the woman appeared almost as a sister, friendly and likable. My patient could not understand why she should dream so favorably about a person she disliked. But these dreams were trying to convey the idea that she herself was shadowed by an unconscious character that resembled the other woman. It was hard for my patient, who had very clear ideas about her own personality, to realize that the dream was telling her about her own power complex and her hidden motivations, unconscious influences that had more than once led to disagreeable rows with her friends. She had always blamed others for these, not herself. It is not merely the shadow side of our personalities that we overlook, disregard, and repress. We may also do the same to our positive qualities. An example that comes to mind is that of an apparently modest and self-effacing man with charming manners. He always seemed content with a back seat, but discreetly insisted on being present. When asked to speak, he would offer a well-informed opinion, though he never intruded it. But he sometimes hinted that a given matter could be dealt with in a far superior way at a certain higher level, though he never explained how. In his dreams, however, he constantly had encounters with great historical figures such as Napoleon and Alexander the Great. These dreams were clearly compensating for an inferiority complex, but they had another implication. What sort of man must I be, the dream was asking, to have such illustrious callers? In this respect, the dreams pointed to a secret megalomania, which offset the dreamer's feeling of inferiority. This unconscious idea of grandeur insulated him from the reality of his environment and enabled him to remain aloof from obligations that would be imperative for other people. He felt no need to prove, either to himself or to others, that his superior judgment was based on superior merit. He was, in fact, unconsciously playing an insane game, and the dreams were seeking to bring it to the level of consciousness in a curiously ambiguous way. Hobnobbing with Napoleon and being on speaking terms with Alexander the Great are exactly the kind of fantasies produced by an inferiority complex. But why, one asks, could not the dream be open and direct about it, and say what it had to say without ambiguity? I have frequently been asked this question, and I have asked it myself. I am often surprised.